I had a 35 kill, 2 solo win, 3.5 hour PUBG game yesterday.
That's too much. That's about 2.5 hours too much. I killed 3 hours too
35
much.
People, how Brad.
That was a single match?
No. That was like that was over a period of like 6 or 7. Yeah, I won 2 games.
A sitting.
Yeah, that was a session.
A session. Was that last night?
Yesterday afternoon.
Okay. And yet here you are at 7:45 in the morning.
Here I am, ready to murder.
True.
Ready to murder some podcasts.
This is the truest sweatpants tech pod that we've done to date.
I didn't take a shower this morning.
I didn't either. I'm sitting here with half a cup of coffee.
My parents were here this last week in town, and they experienced what it's like to be me. They had the Will Smith experience.
Yeah, what is that like?
No, it's not great. It's you get up in the morning, you shovel a kid out the door,
small child involved, small business,
maybe brush your teeth by 11 o'clock. Like the mistake I've made is that my work at home ritual is bad.
Okay.
Like instead of you're supposed to get up and like put your clothes on, take a shower, put your clothes on, have coffee.
That's the Norm Chan routine.
That's Norm claimed to do that. I don't buy that Norm does that. And that all went out the window when we had a kid.
Yeah.
So now it's that I roll out of bed and I just look at my phone. I'm like, I got to answer these emails. So I answer the emails and then I get on Slack and I answer the Slacks. And by the time all that is done, it's usually like 11:30. And I maybe had a cup of tea or a cup of coffee and I'm gross. Like I got the night sweats on me still. Okay. And I got to like, then I'm like, I got to make lunch before I do this shower. So then I ate lunch. And then at like 2:15, when my daughter is like 20 minutes from coming home, I'm like, shit, I got to go take a shower. So she doesn't think I'm a hobo. And then I go take a shower and then I feel decent.
Sounds chaotic.
3 o'clock in the afternoon.
I think I understand why you feel the urge to hop online and shoot people.
That's why I love shooting people so much. It's so good. Welcome to another episode of Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
Hello, Will.
Hello, Brad.
Hi, that's me.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
It's really early today.
It is.
This is my normal podcasting hour.
Last time, is it really?
Yeah, 7 o'clock is when we usually do Still Entitled.
Last time we did a night podcast.
Yeah, that was too late.
Now we're doing a super early morning podcast.
Yeah, we're all over the place this week.
Yeah.
It's time for Q&A.
It is.
We've done 3 episodes.
These things come out of nowhere.
Two of them were about the same thing, but that's true. Feel like it still fits. We got a lot of questions about Windows, I feel like.
And that was a lot of talk about Windows. Those were long episodes.
I felt bad breaking it up into 2 episodes, but sometimes it was too long.
Quantity over quality, man.
Yeah, that's the other way.
People just want hours of stuff to put on and half listen to.
Yeah, I want something I can listen to while I'm playing some Diablo clone.
Yeah. I feel like every time one of these email episodes comes up, it's like, didn't we just do one of these? But it's like one a month.
Well, for other podcasters out there, we had a real innovation last time.
Yeah.
I sent an email to ourselves.
What?
When we recorded the last email episode. So we would have a marker in the email feed of where to stop reading emails.
Does that count as a life hack? What is that?
I think that's a pro tip.
Is that an exploit?
Wait, is GamePro still around? They aren't, right?
No,
definitely. Yeah, then it's a pro tip for sure.
Okay. Wait, do we get to make little 5-point illustrations of ourselves?
Sure.
To slap on the review,
They made action figures, man.
What?
Yeah, a lot of those guys ended up at Future and they're friends.
Oh, wow.
And they had like Dan Amrick had a Dan Electro action figure.
Huh.
That they made, I think, as like an advertiser chotch or something. I don't know what it was for.
But is that a sign of like some delusion of grandeur to make action figures of yourself?
No, I think that's a sign of a marketing department with money that they had to burn.
Okay. That's how most things get done, I think.
Yeah. Hey, we have budget. We got to do something. I don't know what. We can, for a few $1,000, we make some action. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Action figures is great. What about Funko Pops?
Do you want to read some emails?
Sure.
All right. How about, first of all, what was the email address again?
Oh, it's techpod@content.town. You're very good at this, you know. That was a very smooth segue.
I knew it was something like that.
Techpod@content. It's just like the URL, but with an at instead of a dot in one of the places.
Yeah. We're efficient like that.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. The first email comes from Royce.
Hello, Royce.
I like that name.
It's a good name.
It sounds fancy.
Yeah,
sounds like
yeah, it sounds like you should be buttled.
Sounds like land owning European old money or something to me.
Yeah, like I'm out of the summer estate this week. But I wanted to ask some questions.
The country house.
But, you know, when we named our daughter, there was a question about whether we were choosing names that were appropriate for our social status.
Mm.
Like, you don't want to. Like, I feel like if you name a kid Porsche, you're making billionaire claims.
You're sending a certain message.
Yeah, that's not what. Yeah, anyway,
fake it with your child's name until you make it.
I feel like that's like there's a white trash, you know, billionaire scale there. You got to be careful with.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Email from Royce. Just listen to your great episode on NASA. I meant to omit the word great there. Well, when I read this before in my mind, I was like, okay, when you read that, don't say great.
Don't say, well, now you've really called attention to it. So that's, well,
I'm going
to
start
totally smooth.
I'm gonna start over. Just listen to your episode on NASA's. It came in a good time because I'm currently ripping all of my DVDs to a Plex server for easier and remote access.
Ooh.
I'm not the most tech savvy person, but luckily Plex has a pretty easy UI and I'm currently working with an off the shelf tower CPU. However, I'm hoping to have something that uses substantially less power and that I won't have to worry about leaving up 24/7. Upon some research, it seems somewhat common for people to set up a Raspberry Pi as a dedicated Plex server with an external hard drive. Do you have any opinions on this? And then he links to a thing on Amazon. He says, I'm currently thinking this $100 Raspberry Pi 4 kit on Amazon with an 8 terabyte spinning disk USB drive might be adequate. So he wants to know if basically that setup is... And this Raspberry Pi kit he linked to is basically just, it's like the Pi, an enclosure, the power supply, SD card. It's just sort of the all-in-one get started kit.
So I haven't used the newest Raspberry Pi, which 4. Is supposed to be pretty beefy.
Yes.
I don't know if it's transcode video beefy.
Yeah, that's where I maybe get hung up on this.
Yeah. So
it might be okay. I would say probably anything prior to a Raspberry Pi 4 is going to be pushing your luck in terms of what you can transcode.
I would think that's probably fine.
I should point out if I'm not mistaken, the Pi 4 is the first one with USB 4.
That's true.
I mean, I'm sorry, USB 3 ports.
Yeah. But I mean, that shouldn't matter for video because the videos are pretty low bitrate.
Bit rate is not that high.
So yeah, the gate for that is going to be how much CPU you have. I mean, like whether you've ripped the files that you're putting on the Plex server in a way that they'll play natively on whatever devices you're using. So if you're using Android devices, you're kind of fine with whatever because they can play a ton of stuff. They can handle soft subtitles, all that. For iOS and Roku and whatever other set-top box, Apple TV, whatever set-top boxes you're using, including like the ones that are built into your 4K TV, you're going to want to go to Plex's codecs page and find out what, like, which clients support soft subtitles. Cause you like, ideally, if you're going through the hassle of ripping all your disks, you don't want to do things like burn subtitles in. You want to be able to use the soft subtitle so you can turn them on and off. But if you're using a low power server, you know, if you want to watch a movie with subtitles on and they're soft subtitles and your viewing client doesn't support soft subtitles, which a lot of the iOS stuff doesn't, and some of the like consoles even don't.
Yeah.
You need to have enough horsepower to re-encode that video on the fly with those subtitles burned in. Yep. So your mileage may vary. I would think a Pi 4 would probably be fine.
It's probably fine.
For DVD res, especially.
It's a quad core. I think it's 1.5 gigahertz.
But it's still ARM,
it's,
right?
It is ARM, but it's like one of the newer...
Yeah, and
versions.
It probably and also Plex has hardware transcode support built in now for specific chipsets. I don't know if it supports the ARM stuff. I know the Intel integrated video transcode hardware is now supported if you're on the right platform. So if you're on like Debian Linux and using the right kernel and you flip some flags, then you can get hardware transcode, which will solve that problem entirely.
Yeah.
So I guess my point is you may be better off looking at like a low power Intel system, like a Nuke or one of those Atom sticks or something
How you say it? Nuke?
Nuke.
In my head, it's always Nuke.
Oh man, it's like the RoboCop drugs. You gotta get that nuke, bro.
Okay, now I'm on board.
Yeah,
I get it. The video transcode issue aside, like a Pi 4 and a USB hard drive is perfectly fine. It's just a real quick and dirty NAS kind of stuff.
Have a good backup strategy.
Yes, you should not make that your sole repository of that data if you care about that data. But
yeah, I mean,
just for serving files on a network, that is totally fine.
I mean, and honestly, you can get real fancy if you want to do that and like set up a second one at a friend's house and sync those sync those pools with each other.
It's a little DIY cloud storage.
Yeah.
I really want to buy a Pi 4, and I should have already. It's so stupid, but I'm hung up on that dumb USB-C power bug they ran into with that thing. So I'm waiting till they get a revision out there that fixes that.
I used my Pi 4 money to buy a YubiKey the other day.
That's probably a smarter use of that money. Let's see. How about, speaking of InfoSec, so we did that InfoSec episode, since you mentioned the YubiKey.
I was really pleased that nobody yelled at us. Yeah. Nothing makes me more nervous than doing stories about InfoSec and being terrified that I will mess it up.
Strong opinions in that crowd.
Yeah. And
high consequence for failure. Or,
and
getting
also
it wrong can be quite damaging.
And the best practices aren't always intuitive.
Yeah.
Like, that's the other thing about that space. So anyway.
For example, you might think your Netflix account is well protected, and yet
turns out it isn't.
They might keep charging you over and over.
I'm customer service is resolved. They escalated to their security team. Complaining on Twitter always works.
Yeah,
I always feel skeezy.
I hate that's so effective. I've never had to do it, but like, I guess if you have no other choice, explain people what we're alluding to?
Yeah, the TLDR is that somebody kept canceling my Netflix account, basically, without me doing it. When I called Netflix to find out what was happening, they acted like the person was logged in when they were doing it, which was very worrisome to me, because I use single password, unique passwords for each service. It was a really long password. It had symbols and numbers and digits. It wasn't shared with anybody. Like, I hadn't broken any of the rules.
There's
a problem on their end.
Yeah.
Or one of my machines was compromised. Right. Like,
when you break down the ways that people could get access to that account on your end, they're all pretty terrifying.
It was real thin.
Somebody has either breached your password vault, or they've got a keylogger installed on your machine, or some way they are getting access to stuff in a really frightening way.
Well, it could have also been like 10 years ago. They don't sign people out when you change passwords by default.
Okay.
So also 10 years ago, I had a bad password on that before I started using 1Password.
Wow.
So like, if somebody's been sitting there in for a decade, but they didn't show up in the recent activity list.
Interesting. So my Netflix account also got compromised four or five years ago or something.
Really?
I also used a terrible password.
Yeah,
I think it was somebody in Germany that signed into it and hijacked it.
Yeah, of course.
They signed in, they changed the password, and then they upgraded the plan to whatever the most expensive.
Well, that's nice of them.
At that time, it was super easy. I can't remember if I live chatted or called somebody, but they fixed it in 5 minutes.
Well, so I did the live chat, and the customer service representative was so profoundly unhelpful that I flew into a rage and I complained on Twitter like an asshole.
You exercised the nuclear option.
And
you debased yourself.
Look, I'm not proud to say this. At one point I was like, look, I was like, can you escalate me to a manager? And they were like, no, I was like, or what I said was, can you escalate me to a manager, or are you just going to send me to somebody else on your tier and they're going to act like they're your manager?
And
they were like, I can't tell you that.
Wow.
And I was like, well, shit. So my only option is to go complain to 100,000 people on Twitter. And he was like, no, I can't comment on that. I was like, okay, here we go. Let's dance.
Oh, wait, you actually told him that?
Yeah, I told the customer service manager. I was like, look, this is going to be a problem for you.
Exercise some real care and energy.
Look, here's the thing. I know they train customer service people not to apologize for a mistake on the part of the service. I know that's part of the drill.
Yeah. But sometimes the service is at fault.
If you had said, I'm sorry you're having this problem, I would have been 90% less pissed.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, so InfoSec.
Yeah, it's remarkable how many people don't understand this, that getting people to do what you want has everything to do with how you treat them.
Yeah.
Instead of flying into a rage at people.
Yeah. Wait, are you saying I shouldn't have flown into a rage? They should have flown into a rage.
I'm just saying, some politeness goes a long way.
Yeah, there you go.
With this stuff. Anyway, all right, we got a couple of InfoSec emails here to go through.
Ooh.
Here's one from Edwin. I'm surprised you guys didn't touch on unsecured public Wi-Fi and VPN during the recent InfoSec episode.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
I mean, VPNs are useful, especially if you're doing things that you don't want necessarily tied to your IP address that you're on. Most of the web these days, because it's all SSL encrypted, I'm much less worried about the security problems of unencrypted Wi-Fi at this point, to the point that I don't use VPNs when I'm on airport Wi-Fi anymore.
No kidding.
Well, also often you have to put in a password now for airport Wi-Fi. I mean, Like,
well, that's not going to stop a malicious, like an attacker, from getting on there as well.
No, right? But SSL is pretty reliable, okay. Pretty robust.
Yeah.
I mean,
but it's not universal.
It isn't universal, but like all of the, imagine what was the last time you logged into a website that wasn't SSL encrypted at this point?
About a month ago.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, they do exist. This is an outlier at this point. I shouldn't. This sounds like I'm scaremongering here, because it was such an outlier when it happened that I was like, it's 2020. What the fuck,
yeah,
are you people? It's, I don't want to put any small businesses on blast that I patronize, but I mean, it's the place I get my hair cut.
It takes like five minutes to get an SSL certificate now. Let me do it automatically.
I'm just going
to
complain about this real quick. They now have like an online kind of appointment portal.
That's really nice.
And I was like, okay, cool. I can make my haircut appointments online now. I go there. They not only require you to input a credit card address before you can even make the appointment, but then I looked at the address bar, and sure enough, there was no HTTPS, like Chrome through the, hey, this is an unprotected website.
Maybe don't do your credit card here.
No, I didn't. I absolutely did not. Yeah, I just went back to calling them on the phone, because like, you're expecting me to put my credit card number into an unsecured website.
But there's services for that. Why do you not have a certain, like, my place just pays somebody else, like Open Table for hair.
Just whoever set it up, I just didn't know what they were doing. It's unfortunate, but anyway, like you're right. Most
like even content sites, like the New York Times, Giant Bomb is SSL encrypted. I think at this point, right? Seems like it is.
Probably.
Yeah, I didn't get an error when I typed a password the other day.
Sure.
Yeah. So I feel like the VPN. Like, those are special use things for special use.
To be clear, for anybody who doesn't know, when you're logged into a VPN, it's going to be encrypting 100% of the traffic you send through that pipe. So you're protected on anything you do. If you're on like an airport or like a public, like a Starbucks Wi-Fi or something.
But I mean, the problem with stuff like a lot of the free VPNs, they're free VPNs, they're paid VPNs. And then there's stuff like Tor, the Onion router.
Yeah.
Which is a different kind of VPN and kind of anonymizes your traffic a little bit.
I feel afraid even talking about or going near that subject.
Why?
Because it's just so skeezy, man. I mean, it's the dark web.
Well, yeah. I mean, the problem with Tor is that I think, at least the last time I used it, in order to connect to somebody else's node, you had to open up your end as a node. And the kind of things people use Tor for are things I don't want to be associated with in any way, shape, or form.
Yes.
Which is unfortunate, because Tor is an incredibly valuable service. I'm talking about like child pornography and drugs and stuff like that.
And assassinations.
Yeah. You like bomb making
and yes.
All of the shit that used to be on Usenet and IRC back in the old days. I pay for a VPN. I still pay for a VPN. It's fine.
Yeah.
Like I don't think it's as necessary part of your security toolkit as it was say 10 years ago when not everything was SSL encrypted on the web.
I don't know if I've mentioned it before. I actually set up the VPN on my Edge router.
Oh, so you can.
So I can VPN to my house.
That's nice.
Which does not accomplish the things that most people want to use a VPN for, which is anonymizing your traffic.
Well, but it means you can like manage your server
I can connect to my house and I can access everything on my LAN. But also another nice side benefit of that is that I can do what Edwin is talking about when I'm at the airport or whatever. And like you said, it's kind of maybe security overkill at this point, but like, you know, if I hop on the airport Wi-Fi on my phone, I just immediately connect to my home VPN.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not like anonymizing or any of the primary kind of most people's use cases for VPN, but it gives me that peace of mind of like, okay, anybody else on this airport Wi-Fi can't try to touch anything I'm doing with my financial information here.
I did find out that you can use the VPN to bypass things that are blocked from networks too. So like I was on a GoGo wireless satellite internet connection a few weeks ago.
Sure.
And they didn't let me connect to Discord because they viewed it as like an AV, like a video conferencing app, not a chat app.
Right.
So I just VPN'd in and connected the VPN and I was able to Discord all I wanted.
Okay. So to be clear, like in my example, when I'm VPNing to my house, like the Discord is, or whoever is seeing my IP as my home IP, right?
Yeah. That's exactly right.
That is. I didn't even think about that. That's a nice way to circumvent.
It's a life hack.
Some annoying stuff like that. All right.
What do we got? Let's start some more Q's into A's.
Here's another one from Scott.
Hello, Scott.
A couple weeks ago, you mentioned using facial recognition on your phone as a method of security. I personally know of two people who have been at a bar or party where they have passed out and had someone use the facial recognition on their phone to open the phone and use Venmo to empty out a bank account.
How the hell did somebody use the phone when you're unconscious?
It's the reason why I'll never use facial recognition on my phone.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah.
A, passing out in public probably the bigger security problem here.
Yeah, be careful.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah.
If you want to get blackout drunk, do it in the privacy of your own home. Maybe also, well, I'm old and have a different perspective on this now than I probably did when I was still drinking that much.
Sure. Ken, is the facial recognition lenient enough to work like with people's eyes closed? I assumed eyes, like something about the dimensions of your iris and pupil probably factor into the biometrics.
You have to make eye contact with the iPhone.
So they would literally have to like pull your eyelids open.
Yeah, like my daughter tries to unlock the phone so she can play games, and yeah. She does the thing where she just jams it up in your face. Yeah. And as long as you don't look at it, it never unlocks.
It's another life hack.
Yeah. But it's also kind of hard not to look at it because it's the most interesting thing in my line of sight at any given moment.
Sure.
So you see it there and you're like, oh, I love that thing.
Yeah. But I also hate it.
It's a problem. If I was doing serious stuff for a living or places where I was concerned about my physical security, I would not use face or fingerprint scanning.
Yeah. Because I think we talked about before, like people have lifted fingerprints off of surfaces and used them to unlock phones. Yeah, so that's not foolproof either.
We did that at Tested. I feel like scotch tape and graphite was enough to do it.
Wow.
Yeah. We might have had to make a mold. I can't remember.
I don't know how valid this is, but I saw a kind of semi-viral tweet going around yesterday that somebody had devised a way to photograph your face, print the lower half of your face onto an N95 breathing mask.
I know Danielle Luskin who does that. Yeah, I know her. She's great.
And then specifically the pitch was, hey, in the middle of a viral outbreak like the coronavirus, you can customize your breathing mask to continue unlocking your phone. I don't know if that actually works, though, or not.
I don't know if it works or not.
I don't know if there's any 3D depth sensing IR stuff going on that the mask would defeat because it's just a flat surface.
Well, but it's not a flat surface. It's dome.
Well, it wouldn't replicate the depth of your facial features.
If you look at my face, like I have beard obscuring my bone structure. I don't know. Yeah. Like when the face recognition stuff came out with iOS and Android, we heard lots of reports of siblings and children working because their face structure, their bone structure was similar enough. Their face looked similar enough to their relatives.
Interesting.
I feel like any of the biometric stuff, like, look, if you're really concerned about security, get one of those NFC UB keys and use that to sign into your phone. Use that to sign into your accounts. Like that's if you have real security needs, that's what you need is a hardware dongle and a password.
And then throw that thing down the nearest storm drain if somebody takes your phone and is trying to get into it. Just
bite it in half.
Sure. Yeah. Swallow it.
Yeah. No, they can get that back. It'll just take a couple of days.
That was actually only the first half of his email. Here's the other half.
But wait, there's more.
In the same episode, Brad mentioned that a credit card company of his doesn't use two-factor authentication. This doesn't surprise me, as there are large parts of the banking and credit card systems that are still running on computers and software built in the 80s. The mortgage system is even worse. The system used by huge banks like Wells Fargo and Citibank was actually written in COBOL.
Oh, great.
And is so bad that all the bank's servicing centers talk to each other to find ways around all the problems they run into, trying to work new regulations into an ancient system. I always smirk when I use my 2020 laptop to log into a system that doesn't recognize a mouse and looks like it would be futuristic in the movie Hackers. He sounds like he works in this industry.
Remember in 1998 when they had to get all the lords of COBOL who knew how to COBOL program back in to fix the Y2K bug?
Yeah.
They had to pull all these people out of retirement. Yeah,
do you know anything about that language? It's just a very early primitive machine language.
It's what IBM used. It's not a machine language.
Oh, no?
It's a higher level than that, but I don't know anything about it. It was the thing that if I wanted to take programming in seventh grade, it was either that or Fortran is what they would have taught us.
Okay, interesting. Someone kind of more simplified than C.
I think it's more specialized. I think it was for IBM mainframes.
I see. Okay.
So it was for data processing, large scale data processing.
Huh.
It's kind of what I think people would use Python for, but I'm sure people will send in questions for the next one to correct me on this because I don't know.
Sure.
I don't want to get into specifics of what my bank uses for two-factor authentication because it's bad.
Yeah.
And I don't want to tell everybody what bank I use. Every bank I've ever used has had a non-standard two-factor authentication.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So they don't use OTP. They don't use YubiKeys. They don't use the Google Authenticator, whatever that spec is. It's always text you a four-digit code or something terrible.
Like the very accounts that you most want to protect are the least secure by nature, and it's just, it's infuriating.
Well, and also your check comes with the, like your printed checks have the information needed to like extract money from accounts if, for somebody who is even this. Anyway, banks are problematic.
Yeah.
This is why we should all go to Bitcoin.
Just
get that Ethereum rolling, and we're going to use that to buy our groceries from Newegg.
Just throw this on the list of ways the financial industry screws everybody else over.
Yeah. It would be nice if more people supported two-factor authentication in a industry standard way.
Yes. Cannot agree more. Okay. Josh from Brooklyn. Did you guys ever use, he entitled this email, sick CD drive.
Ooh.
Did you guys ever use a CD writer that etched the top of the CD with an image? That existed, right?
HP Laser Writes.
I heard about them as a kid and always wanted to use one instead of writing with a Sharpie on my new mix CDs.
Hold on. It was called...
Was that just an HP thing? Or I remember... HP... I vaguely remember that stuff. I assume...
You had to flip it over in the...
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I can't remember what it was called.
I assume they just used some kind of like different type of like photochemical covering that they could burn with a laser.
Yeah, that was exactly
basically
it was like
something
it was like
lines.
A single tone.
Okay. So you're not going to get colors.
Solid top. You didn't get colors, but it would just kind of like give a tone color on color.
Yeah.
Label on the top. I had one of those drives.
Really? Did you actually use that feature?
Twice.
Okay.
Because you know what? Usually it's like
pain.
Usually I would burn the disc.
Yeah.
And then I would be like, well, okay, this one is blah blah blah. Write it on the top with a Sharpie.
Yeah.
And then chuck it back on the spindle.
Yes.
Because I don't remember. It's funny. I have no idea what I used optical burners for once I stopped burning audio CDs.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like we, I you know, that's not true. I did burn a bunch of MP3 CDs to share music with friends.
Oh, totally.
Back in those heady days.
It was that and just like backing up data occasionally.
Kind of.
If you needed to, even though it was a terrible way to back things up.
I remember once when I changed PCs and I was moving the hard drive from one computer to another, and downloads were problematic because I was on DSL. I feel like I probably backed up all of the Steam installed games.
Yes,
to
I totally
CDs,
did that.
And then before like external, but once external, like once you could get a cheap USB external hard drive or thumb drive, it was like, I'm forget done with this. It.
Yes.
This is terrible.
I think I've got an unopened spindle of like 50, either they're probably DVD-Rs if I had to guess, but I'm pretty sure I've got like a stack of blank discs that will never be used in a box somewhere.
Well, so Frank Cifaldi of the Video Game History Museum and Jason Scott were both talking of the Internet Archive. We're both talking about the reliability of old media, like floppy disks and old CDRs. And we're reaching the 20-year period on CDRs.
Totally.
So they're going to start, presumably the dies have started breaking down.
Yeah, because you had like, I guess probably like the Sega CD, some of those first CD-ROM, the companies would be sending out presumably, you know, beta versions of games on written. I mean, you know, all through like the PS2 era at GameSpot, we were getting burned discs of preview builds and even review builds of stuff all the time.
Oh, I got burned discs from EA for PC games until I left Maximum PC.
Yeah.
That stuff, the floppy disks, they're starting to get bad sectors on floppy disks from the 80s now.
Do they break down even in storage?
Seems like they do. I mean, also...
Well, they're magnetic, so I guess that's subject to...
Cosmic rays.
EM corruption.
Yeah. Well, but also, presumably the people who are storing... Like, people put floppy disks in their attic and their garage and the places that are not necessarily climate controlled.
Yes,
so that
would make sense.
You know, if they get hot, then they're they're more likely to lose data and stuff like that.
All right, that's a good segue to this email from Jason. Speaking of preserving your digital property.
Lightscribe is what it was called.
Yes, right. Okay, now I remember that. What a cool, ridiculous, useless gimmick.
I mean, the first time we got that in, we were like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
And then we realized you have to be able to draw in order to make any use of it at all.
Sure.
Yeah.
Anyway. Also, how much, you know, it takes 5 seconds to write a name with a Sharpie versus probably 20 minutes
pretty
to
slow.
make an image and flip the disc and okay. All right. Jason says, during your NAS episode, you mentioned having all of your media, music, and movies all digital and able to watch anywhere. My question is, what do you recommend for digitizing CDs, DVDs, and Blu-rays? And what do you store them on? I have a 4 terabyte USB hard drive. Can this be used or do I need a NAS for this? No, you definitely don't need a NAS.
No.
You can Even if you're just going to back that stuff up, you can throw it on any old drive. But
plug it in Windows.
The bigger question here is he's asking how to actually like extract and digitize in different ways.
I haven't ripped an audio CD in probably 10 years.
Wow, really? So I just redid all of mine like a few months ago when I embarked on a quest to rebuild my entire music library in FLAC.
Yeah. What did you use EAC still?
So yeah, okay. Exact Audio Copy is still, from what I could tell, the best thing out there, as far as I could tell.
Okay.
It's pretty, it's not the easiest thing to set up.
No, but it is very robust. Most importantly, it tells you if you're going to have an error. The problem with iTunes always was that it would just let her rip. And if you had a skip or something, it would just try to fix it as best it could. Yeah. It wouldn't say, hey, there's going to be a problem in the middle of... so you wouldn't get to like Tangerine on Led Zeppelin 3 and be like, what the hell is this horrible sound?
Right.
Yeah.
EAC will very exhaustively tell you if there's anything wrong with the disc. But again, it's like it's pretty technical and detailed to set up in terms of like, you have to tell it which encoder you want to use, where the executable for that is located, like give it a bunch of command switches for quality and stuff like that. Like it's not super user friendly.
Yeah.
But once you get it set up, it's pretty easy to just throw discs in and go. For those Meat Puppets CDs that I may or may not ever actually listen to again.
Well, the nice thing is once you do set that up, it's not like ripping movies where you have to kind of eyeball it every single time.
So as far as movies go, I just got rid of all my old DVDs. I never bothered to rip them.
Oh,
I just donated them instead because they're filthy standard definition. I don't want that shit.
Wow.
So I can't weigh in on how to rip DVDs specifically.
So I use a piece of software called Make MKV.
Yeah. So that's what I use for Blu-rays, but yeah. I wasn't sure if that also worked
for everything. For DVDs
as well. Okay.
So you basically with Make MKV, you pull off, the way DVDs are structured is like each DVD is a container and the container has some video and some audio and some subtitles and then sometimes some extra stuff.
Yeah. There's like menu files and it's all like the player interprets the menu program.
Yeah.
To kind of figure out how to play the point being like the files on the disc are not one-to-one with the videos you would want to watch.
That's exactly it. It's not like there's just like movie.mpg there.
You can't just like go in File Explorer in Windows and like drag a video file off the disc because they're all broken up across multiple files and it's very arcane.
Well, but Make MKV makes that stuff visible and accessible.
Somewhat visible. it doesn't necessarily label everything for you though. That's the problem.
You have to find it. DVDs are a lot easier than Blu-rays because there's a lot fewer extra things on Blu-rays and like the data is structurally less complicated.
Yeah.
The biggest challenge you have with DVDs is like sometimes there's two versions of the movie on the same disc. There's like a matted cropped version for 4x3 TVs and then a 16x9 one. The process is open MKV, look at the disc, pick the content that you want out of the disc, save that to your hard drive, and then point Handbrake at that video. And what Make MKV does is literally puts a Matryoshka MKV file with all of the... It doesn't recompress anything. Yep. So all of the low compression MPEG-2 Dolby Digital 5.1 or GTS audio is just saved to your hard drive. Yep. So you'll have like a 7 gig file.
It's a perfect replication of what was on the disc.
Yeah. And then you point Handbrake at that 7 gig file and you say, okay, turn this into H.264, H.265.
Or
you just save the whole thing because you're a maniac.
If you're bawling out of control like I am.
God, you're just ripping whole Blu-rays?
You stop before the Handbrake stop.
Wow.
It's ridiculous. I know.
That's just... That's
okay. Yeah, they're huge. Like let's say a full-length movie.
Blu-rays can be 50 gigs.
Different Blu-rays use different compression algorithms, so it can vary, but I would say it's probably like 30, average like 30 gig a movie.
Wow.
35 for like a two-hour movie. It's ridiculous. I'm going to have to start compressing stuff at some point. I love the idea of having like the literal Blu-ray movie at the exact same quality.
Well, so if you're going to do that, you can just keep the ISO and then use, I think, I want to say Kodi lets you just navigate the menus.
Okay.
I don't know if it does it for Blu-ray, but it definitely does it for
Blu-ray
DVD.
Playback on PC is terrible you basically have to buy playback software. Like VLC doesn't handle it properly. And like you can't just, like I can't throw my Terminator 2 Blu-ray into the PC and just play it. And so... No. You do have to extract the MKV that way, but whatever.
I like to pull English language tracks, all the English subtitles, And that way you get director commentaries too. Because I love a good director commentary.
Yes.
You can also go through really easily and find like extra features and stuff like that. So if you want to get like the making of featurettes and all that, it's easy to do.
Yeah. MakeMKV will break everything out by what they call title, which like a title is essentially a video program. Like it's the movie or it's the behind the scenes feature or it's, you know, it's what you would watch as a video from start to finish on the disc in a player. But
sometimes it's like the FBI warning.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It might be a trailer. It might be, it's a self-contained video. Yeah. The reason I bring that up though, is it can get confusing if you were to put in, let's say a Japanese animation.
Yes.
Or, you know, like a foreign language film,
like Japanimation.
Like frequently you will get like two or even three titles side by side that are all three the same size. They're all like 27 gig or 35 gig. And it doesn't go to any length to tell you what the differences are. You just have to eyeball like, okay, this one has the English and a bunch of European language tracks. And this one has only English and Japanese. So the difference must be that this one has the credits all in Japanese. You know what I mean?
Like Pixar does.
Yeah.
Credits in French, English, and Spanish and for North America.
The point I'm making is that MakeMKV does not tell you anything about what the differences are, so you really have to just sort of try to intuit which one is the one you actually want.
I realized
it's kind of a mess.
I realized a few weeks ago that I ripped the French version of Monsters University, but it still has the English audio track.
Right.
But I was watching it with my daughter.
All the signage is in French.
Yeah, all the even like the handwritten signs in the world.
Okay, I was going to ask. So Pixar, I'm sure, has enough attention to detail
so good.
To go through the entire movie like and translate everything.
All of the fraternity signs, like the join this club, all this are all in French. And it was, Monsters University is in, anyway.
I mean, that's one of the cool things about the Blu-ray format is that they use branching video so that they can do that. They can fit multiple versions of a movie on the same disc because it just branches back and forth to the different language stuff.
Blu-ray is awesome.
But it makes it harder to figure out how to rip stuff.
I mean, I think how easy it is to rip probably wasn't a primary design consideration for the spec.
Certainly not. Speaking of ripping stuff.
I love ripping.
Here's an email from Jabril.
Okay.
I've been wondering what experiences both of you have with console modding, dumping games, and emulation.
Ooh.
Lately, I've started down a rabbit hole learning how to dump DS, GameCube, Wii U, PS2, and PS3 to my PC. It started with buying a used DS and tinkering with custom firmware, escalated to buying a Wii U so I could dump used Wii and Wii U discs, and then culminated in hunting down a specific model of CD drive that is capable of reading GameCube discs. It's been fun to explore GitHub repositories and old forum posts for answers to obscure questions. Plus, it's nice to know that I don't have to rely on the benevolence of console manufacturers to maintain access to my library of older titles. Have you messed with any of this stuff at all?
So once upon a time, there was a moment when it was really easy to hack a Wii. And I don't remember the specific mechanics, but basically you just downloaded something and put it on the SD card that was plugged in there.
I've looked into this. I've never done any of this stuff, but I've looked into that more recently. And there's like, I think depending on which version of firmware you're on your Wii, there's different methods.
Yeah.
A lot of it has to do with like, it might be the web browser or maybe some mail client or something. There's like some of the like system level.
Or Netflix. Like there was a third party app you installed. It might have just been the Wii Shop channel. I can't remember.
It depends.
Yeah.
Like, I think one of them uses like the messages interface for some kind of exploit. Anyway, it's still possible.
You basically had to follow a series of convoluted and seemingly arbitrary steps. And then at the end you had a piece of software on the thing that was basically like the Wii jailbreak channel then you could rip any of the GameCube or Wii discs
Wii. Don't just read in any old CD drive on a PC. Although it sounds like he found one that does.
Like there's a whole world of hacking firmware on your optical drive, so it'll do weird stuff.
Yeah.
Like right now, the best way to rip UHD discs that I'm aware of, your 4K Blu-rays,
is to mod a firmware on a
4K Blu-ray drive.
There are a bunch of what are just advertised as regular BD-ROMs, I should say.
Yeah.
Like Blu-ray drives for your computer that can physically read UHD 4K discs, but they don't out of the box. But you can make that work. I have not, but I've read about it.
No comment.
I've looked into this stuff.
It was really easy for the Wii.
Really?
Yeah. Okay.
I don't have a Wii, so I could probably.
How did you never have a Wii? Had a Wii.
I never bought a Wii. Somehow I never bought a Wii. We had Wiis at work for the four Wii games that I cared about playing.
Well, so I wanted to rip GameCube games.
Yeah. That's my biggest objective, and I've never done it, but that's what I would like to do.
But like the ones that I really was excited about, like the Rogue Squadron games, don't play in Dolphin, or didn't at the time. I haven't come back to them in a long time.
Okay.
They used some weird rendering technique that just was off, unlike anything else on that platform.
Yeah.
The Wii, I played Skyward Sword on the PC, and it was great. I played it at like 1080p, 60 frames a second.
Sure.
Still really slow start.
Yeah.
Ripping the disc, you just get an ISO, and then you can point Dolphin at the ISO. It took a surprising number of tries because there was no like error correction on the rip. So some of the ISOs would come out bad,
okay,
and you'd have to do them again. And I don't know why that happened, but it was just a fact of life. I just as a shout out, I love the round edges on the Wii U discs.
Dude,
it's the best thing about that thing.
Pulled a Wii U disc off my shelf like a month ago.
So good.
I haven't actually played one of those things in 2 years or something, but I pulled it out just to touch the edges of the disc because it's so nice.
My daughter and I play the Catsuit Mario, Super Mario 3D World on the reg. That's a great game. And we almost have all of the worlds unlocked.
Nice.
It's taken a long time.
You're gonna get to that ultimate super crazy hard level.
Those round edges feel so good.
They're the best. I've looked into a related topic a good bit and have not been brave enough to try it. Which is modding your Wii U, soft modding your Wii U to play GameCube games.
Wait, what?
So the Wii U natively can play Wii games.
Which means it can play GameCube games?
Right, but they did not enable that feature.
I assumed it was because the optical drive couldn't deal with those tiny discs.
No, it can read them.
Wow.
So there is a software mod for Wii U's that, so I've got 25, maybe 30 GameCube games in my closet in a box. And there's some great games.
Real bangers, yeah.
And you know, even the Wii never had HDMI out, right? Wasn't it component only?
The Wii had component out. Yeah, you had to use the GameCube component cables.
I think that's why I ended up caring about this, because the Wii U was the first Nintendo console with proper digital HDMI out. Yeah, so I was like, oh, I want the thing that has an HDMI out to be able to play my GameCube games. But
boy.
And it's possible. Like, you can do it. It's not the easiest mod, but the thing that's always spooked me is just like, I don't know, what if they ban my console for all that online Wii U stuff I'm doing?
Well, and also it's probably still attached to your Switch account. That would be real bad.
That's what I mean, is like Nintendo can be kind of onerous about online security stuff like that. And like, I just don't know if it's worth the risk. The other thing is, I haven't looked into this in a while, but secondhand Wii U's,
they're real expensive.
Are not easy to come by.
No, I thought ours was dead a few months ago, and it was a real source of tragedy in our house.
Sure.
And when I went to look at how much after, you know, secondhand Wii U's cost, it was more expensive than it was when it was new.
Yeah,
it
totally.
Was like $400.
It has to be just, I assume, because they ended manufacturing early because it was kind of a failure.
Yeah. Well, and like, if you look at the list of titles that came, the software is real cheap. So you can get discs pretty inexpensively, but like, it's a pretty good catalog for a machine that sold like 8 million units.
There are some legitimately great games on the Wii U.
Yeah.
And you know, most of them are coming to the Switch now, so that's kind of moot.
You want to do one more?
Sure. How about Alex?
It's coming out on March 23rd. I'm ready.
Okay.
Give it to me.
Alex wrote in.
Well, this is awkward.
Yes. Alex wrote in with a bone to pick about our Windows episodes.
Oh, that's fine.
I noticed on your recent episodes where you stack rank the different versions of Windows that you skipped over Windows 98 Second Edition. What's up with that?
Just to be clear, we didn't stack rank.
I think I literally wrote stack rank in one of the episode descriptions. Was that a mistake?
Oh, I feel like stack ranking is a performance review thing.
That was a little inside Microsoft reference.
Yeah, it's the thing everybody hated about working at Microsoft back in the day.
I believe they have ended that practice.
We had a bunch of emails about this, about Windows 98 Second Edition. We also had a bunch of people asking what happened to Windows 9.
It
went from Windows 8 to 8.1 to 10.
I can certainly tell you what I've always heard is the reason.
Seven, eight, nine.
That's not what I was going to know. That's not the reason.
They put that joke in the initial press release.
Did they really? Did they themselves?
Yes.
Oh, man. The thing I always heard about why there was no Windows 9 is that there is way too much legacy software out there with the text string Windows 95 in it. And that it would cause havoc with, if you had something that was Windows 9 and that text string was showing up in places where you might also run into Windows 95, there would be too much like software confusion.
It's not the case.
No.
My understanding is that is not the case.
Okay.
My understanding, and I have not had any kind of confirmation on this, is that it is a straight marketing decision because
around
I think
Apple
9 is the other company that they were really concerned about had a operating system called something 10 The other thing is that in China, the number 9 has a bad luck sound-alike number.
Okay.
And it's also feared in Japan because it's similar to the word for torture and suffering.
Wow.
Those are superstitions. Yeah. But those are two, it's one enormous market for Windows.
Okay.
So,
just kind of kill two birds with one stone.
My understanding is it was probably a marketing decision, but they've never officially confirmed that as far as I know.
Safe for international release and also sound like you're keeping up with Apple.
Yes. I mean, Samsung releases Galaxy 9s and all that. So I don't know that the 9 superstition thing is real. I do know that I'm sure they were concerned about OS 10 because that was also, remember, Windows 10 came out around the time when Mac laptops were really selling like hotcakes.
Usually popular. Absolutely.
Okay. So for the second edition, I don't think Windows 98 second edition is that important.
Okay.
So I didn't put it on the list. I also forgot
about it.
Yeah. It include the things it added were WDM audio model and modem support.
Okay.
So Windows driver model support for audio and modem, which means you don't necessarily have to plug in drivers for like USB modems and USB sound cards to work. It replaced Internet Explorer 4 with Internet Explorer 5. It fixed USB support. It added web folders, the web dev namespace extension for Windows Explorer, which was an incredibly insecure feature, and included FireWire support for camcorders.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Wake on LAN.
Really? Is Wake on LAN that old?
Wake on LAN's been around for a long time.
I just started using that recently.
Yeah, it's pretty handy. Cool. I use it for my Steam Link. It turns on my PC and I can play games.
And they sold a box that said Windows 98 Second Edition on the front.
Windows 98 SE could be obtained as a retail upgrade and full version packages.
Okay.
So it's the kind of thing now that you would buy.
That's a service.
It would just get it for free.
Right.
But it was probably big enough with NetMeeting. New Windows Media Player, like the download was probably substantial enough in a time when most of the home audience was on modems that they had to sell it as a disc.
Would you believe that I am in the process of setting up a COM port, a serial port?
Is this related to your Ubiquiti stuff?
No, I already have a serial cable for that thing. And it saved my ass a couple times. I am enabling it. I'm not gonna do it.
Can we start a BBS?
Absolutely.
That's a Patreon backer bonus. Access to the TechPod BBS.
I don't know how much longer you're gonna be able to get a straight up analog copper phone line into your house.
I think we should do a virtual. It's already on the internet.
I'm guessing dial-in BBS is not gonna work over a VoIP line. If I had to,
I tried to do modems over VoIP at Maximum PC with Vonage when VoIP was new.
Yeah.
It did not work.
Yeah. That's what I expected.
The compression did bad things to the modem sounds. Yeah.
I'm setting up a serial port on my NAS so I can get console output out of that port if necessary.
Oh, that's nice.
Because there have been times when it was related to corrupted boot media, so it's probably not going to happen often, but there have been times when like the SSH and web demons on the NAS broke.
Yeah.
And there was no way to get into the machine.
Well, so how do you get, do you have a USB adapter from on the machine?
Yeah. So that's what I've got for the Ubiquiti router already. Huh. There's a company called FTDI. I forget what it stands for, but they make chipsets that emulate old like serial port type hardware.
Okay.
For USB or it translates. So
get that RS-232.
Yes. So like literally I'm about to order it's RS-232 on one end, USB on the other. And there's a tiny, like I said, little mediating IC in the USB cable.
Okay, so
that makes Windows see it as a COM port, and then you can get serial output.
So where
console output?
So is it just USB to USB?
No. In this case,
have to have another adapter.
What is a D sub or whatever? You call
the 9-pin.
Yeah,
D sub was a Metal Gear thing, I think.
Right. Anyway, whatever. This is old man tech.
Don't you have to do that the other way too?
No,
how do you plug that into one of your modern computers that does not have a serial port?
So my motherboard, I don't know if motherboards still have this, but this is about a 5-year-old motherboard in my NAS.
You have a serial port?
It's got a header. It's got headers on the motherboard for an LPT and COM ports.
Really?
So you have to buy a breakout bracket. Like you have to, just like how you connect the case USB ports to the motherboard.
Yeah.
It also has a header on the motherboard for a COM port.
Holy crap. Anybody still put those on.
And for a printer port. Again, this is about a 5-year-old motherboard. So maybe they've not.
Oh man, I got to go look at the manual for my server. Cause that would have.
Yeah.
Like right now when.
That actually made me think about your problem about not being able to get into your machine.
Yeah. When I have to fix something, I have to like climb up on a ladder and cause it's on a high shelf in my garage. Yeah.
Also, it's like a 10-foot cable. So you can plug that into the serial port on your NAS. OS and then run it down to like a laptop. You can plug it into a MacBook and then you can use screen in a terminal window and straight up get the console output of the machine. It's kind of awesome.
I want to go one step further.
Yeah.
And I want to set up a Raspberry Pi that's plugged into that so I can just remote into the Raspberry Pi. Yeah.
I've seen people talking about using this with a Pi as well.
This sounds great.
It's pretty awesome. This is 45-year-old technology?
Yeah, let's get that 112K kilobits per second.
Serial ports are straight up from like the 60s or 70s. Oh. On the page where I was buying this cable, and on the page, I think it's actually on the Amazon page, like their little splash marketing graphic straight up talks about connecting it to like cash registers and point of sale and like 40-year-old embedded machines that you would need to plug a serial cable into.
The thing that this is going to jack up your Amazon recommendation something fierce. It's going to be like this, and then Metamucil, and adult diapers, a lot of old person stuff.
Yes,
I think that'll do it for us today.
Yeah, that's it.
We've turned the Q's into A's. Uh-huh. If you have more Q's, I think we have a bunch of questions left. We had a bunch of good questions.
Yes, we did not get through all of them by any stretch.
So maybe we'll do another Q&A episode sometime soon, or do a bonus episode or something.
Yeah.
But thank you all for listening. Yeah. The email address again is techpod@content.town. If you have questions about what we've talked about on the show or other things, we're open to
anything.
It's all good. Yeah. You want to ask us about maybe not energy drinks. I feel like that's somebody else's property.
That's to horn in on.
Yeah. We don't want to horn in on Aftermath. Yeah. But we'll be back next week with another episode of the show. If you like us, please leave a review on iTunes. There's still a survey up at survey.content.town. It's going to go away after this week. So if you haven't filled it, if you've already filled it out, great. Don't do anything. You have our undying gratitude. If you have not filled it out, we would love to hear what you think about the show. We've gotten the response to the survey has been astounding.
Yeah.
So thank you all for filling it out. You really do have our undying gratitude. Yeah. This is very helpful.
Yeah. Market research.
Yeah.
Analytics. They come in handy.
It turns out it's good to know what people are thinking about the thing that you spend this time on.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week with another episode of the show. Thanks, Brad. This was fun.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye.